thank everyone for joining us tonight for Citizens Climate Lobby University. All right, so let me start off with a little disclaimer tonight. I'll tell you a little bit about myself, but also want to start off with a disclaimer and let you know that I am not a motivation expert, okay? But before discovering CCL, I did work in the financial services industry, and if that's not motivating, I don't know what is. But no, I did that for a little bit over a decade, but you know, so my background is in business. But when I was at grad school, I really became fascinated with the concept of culture and organizational behavior. And even though I no longer work in the corporate world, to this day I still read books and still read the Harvard Business Review and stupid nerdy things like that. And I really just, for some real weird reason, culture is like really an important concept to me. So what we're going to talk about is how, as a nonprofit, we can take advantage of the very same research that's out there to create a high-performing culture and business world, do that at CCL as well. Now, I don't have all the answers, and the things we'll talk about might not be something that everyone believes in or is comfortable doing, and that's okay, and it's perfectly fine. But on the flip side, I believe a lot of you are probably already doing some of this stuff. You may be calling it something different, but you're already doing some of this, or maybe even all of it. And if that's you, then when we get to the sharing portion of tonight's lesson, I do invite you to share your experiences with the rest of us. And we'll get to that. We'll do that a couple of times throughout the call tonight. So what I'd like to do is just introduce you to a few concepts on motivation and performance and talk about how we're beginning to work those into our team culture here in Texas. And then we'll have that open discussion. We'll talk about it. We'll open it up for everyone to share some best practices, because that's really the richness of our learning and collaboration at CCL, that when we share what we've learned with others, that's really where we seem to do very well. So be prepared to open up and share when we get to that point. So for those of you I haven't met yet, my name is Ricky Bradley. I lead the Dallas, Texas chapter of CCL. And despite what I've learned in school and in the business world, when I first got started with, you know, nonprofit as a group leader, my approach was something like this, that I would look at all the tasks and the action items and things we were supposed to complete each month, you know, the letters to the editor, the lobby meetings, the outreach events. And I would think that what I should do as a group leader is find the right person to do these various tasks, right? That was really contrary to what I had learned in the business world and what I know from about, you know, how to create good cultures and team performance. So what happened with me is I think the same thing that happens with a lot of our chapters is, you know, I ended up doing most everything, and a lot of the rest of the team just sort of assumed that if they didn't help, that, you know, I'd end up doing it eventually and it would get done. That's not normally the best business model, right, or productive model to get things accomplished. So what we're going to learn about in this lesson really is not new. In fact, it's all based on really robust peer-reviewed research that's been around for over a century. Now, how I speak about these concepts tonight, they're really taken from a book called Primed to Perform. If you're watching or seeing the presentation tonight, you can see that book there. It's called Primed to Perform, How to Build the Highest Performing Cultures Through the Science of Total Motivation. It was written by Lindsay McGregor and Neil Doshi. And what they did is they combined a lot of their own original research with the century of academic study into motivation and culture, and they've explained it in a way that is really so easy to comprehend, but also really fairly simple to execute. So let's talk about that. The first thing that McGregor and Doshi say is that before you start talking about developing a high-performing team or culture, that what you really need to do is take a step back and to understand the concept of what is performance. And as leaders, we need to understand and optimize two different types of performance, and they are in direct opposition to each other. Now, the first type of performance is what's called tactical performance. And this represents like how well a person or a group executes a plan. An example of tactical performance at CCL would be, you know, our lobby meetings, right? We schedule a meeting with a member of Congress, we do our research, we gather previous meeting minutes, we meet with the team to come up with a meeting plan, we have a meeting, we debrief the meeting, right? There's a lot of tactical performance or plan, and how well we execute that plan is how well we do with our tactical performance. The opposing type a performance is called adaptive performance. And this is a person or group's ability to diverge from a plan. Again, these things are total opposites. Now, it turns out in most organizations, especially in the corporate world, you spend an inordinate amount of time motivating tactical performance, right? How well people stick to a plan. And there's a pretty simple reason why that's the case, because tactical performance is very easy to measure, right? I'm sure we've all seen scenes like this in a call center, or I used to work in a call center environment, so I know what this is like. It is very structured. There's a lot of things that are easy to measure. You have a schedule, you've got calling metrics, you've got quality assurance and quality control and a script. I mean, it's really pretty simple stuff, right? And you can measure those things. Those are all like systems of tactical performance. Another example is at Starbucks, right? A barista. The barista has to be a great tactical performer. Barista needs to know, like, how many shots of espresso or in a cappuccino, how does the milk, or how, you know, how the temperature of the milk has to be for a latte, or how many pumps of vanilla syrup go into a latte, right? They need to know all these things and be able to perform these things to be a good tactical performer. But the same Starbucks barista has to be a great adaptive performer as well for that store to have a great culture. What does that look like? It looks like, I mean, what does the barista do when they hand me my coffee and I accidentally spill it all over the floor after receiving it, right? Does that barista make me a new one? How well do they adjust when things don't go as planned? That's adaptive performance. Now, here's the most important thing to remember for tonight. It turns out that the highest performing organizations, we're talking like Starbucks, Apple, Whole Foods, Southwest Airlines, you know, all these really high performing organizations, they rank highest in this concept of adaptive performance. Not tactical performance, but adaptive performance. And that makes sense, right? Think about your experience when you are in Walmart and you stop and you can't find something. And you stop to ask an employee at Walmart where something might be located. Think about how that makes you feel. And then put yourself at a Whole Foods and think about the experience when you can't find something and you stop and ask somebody there where something is and the difference that you feel as a person in that store. There's a huge difference, right? The employees at Whole Foods are allowed to stop, drop, and do whatever is necessary to make sure that you're taken care of. You don't usually get that same feeling at a Walmart, I don't think. So we all know that how the experience is different when we interact with those companies. So here's the kicker, or here's the thing that's kind of hard to get your head around. It's really hard for some people to understand that come from a total nonprofit world and maybe haven't worked in a corporate structure before, but we know how to create adaptive organizations. It's not that hard, but there's a reason why we don't do so, or why a lot of companies don't do so. But just remember, the highest performing organizations rank highest in adaptive performance. So how do we do it? Well, it's pretty simple. High performing cultures, or the highest performing organizations, they do one simple thing. They maximize the concept of motivation. So that sounds pretty simple, right? The logical question then is, well, how do we motivate others? But turns out the research shows that that's really the wrong question to ask, or it's a less effective approach. Some of you may be familiar with motivation guru Edward Deston. I mean, his stuff's been around for a long, long time. And he says this, that the proper question is not how can people motivate others, but rather how can people create the conditions within which others motivate themselves? And that's a really important distinction. As leaders, we're going to try to motivate others, or will we be better off by creating the conditions within which others motivate themselves? So when you look at it in this way, maybe the role is not to motivate people to do something, right? That's tactical performance. but to create the conditions within which others motivate themselves, that adaptive performance, because it's that high level of adaptive performance that creates a great culture or a high-performing culture. You can apply that to liaisons as well. So if you're a liaison, you know, our role, we say this a lot, is, you know, not to convince Congress to do something, really, but it is to create the conditions to get, make them motivate themselves to do something, to create the political will out in the district, to create those conditions that allows a member of Congress to motivate themselves. So how do we do that? How do we create those conditions that allow people to motivate themselves? Well, the answer sounds pretty deceptively simple, but it's this, that there are motivators, right? The research clearly shows that why you do something determines how well you do something. So why you do something determines how well you do something. There are six basic reasons why people do something, okay? And although in this book, Trying to Perform, they have a certain terminology for it, there are other research studies and that have different terminology for it, but it's all the same concept. So some people may call it intrinsic or extrinsic motivators or direct or indirect motivators. It's all the same concept, but they may have different names. That's why a lot of this may sound familiar to you. But so there are six basic reasons why people do something. And the thing here to remember is that they're not created equal. So on the first side, what we have are your direct motivators on the left-hand side, and they strengthen adaptive performance. So play, purpose, and potential are direct motivators that strengthen adaptive performance. While, on the other hand, we have emotional pressure, economic pressure, and inertia. They weaken adaptive performance. So environments that maximize the first three and minimize the last three, what the research shows is that individuals experience or exhibit more creativity, more problem solving, more persistence, collaboration, and yes, indeed, citizenship. So the more that you can maximize the three on the left-hand side and minimize the three on the right-hand side, the more creativity, the more problem solving, the more persistence and collaboration and citizenship that you're going to get out of your teams. The highest performing cultures, again, Apple, Southwest, you know, those groups, they build upon this psychology of increasing total motivation throughout their entire organization. They train leaders that way. They design their jobs that way. They really structure their teams to enhance these concepts, to increase play, purpose, and potential, and to eliminate emotional pressure, economic pressure, and inertia. So we're going to do some sharing here in just a moment, so get prepared for that. But first, let's talk about each one of these motivators real quick. And actually, we'll share some examples that maybe you guys have seen of these motivators in your work or in your advocacy in the past as well. So let's start off with play. So the definition of play, you can see at the top, is when it's not play as in having games or having fun, but people feel play at work when the motive for doing the work is the actual work itself. You work because you enjoy the work. And since that motive is created by the work, it's the most powerful driver of high performance. So let me give an example. I'm going to give you my example, but I want you guys to share an example maybe where you've seen people who work just because they love the work itself in just a moment. But for me, it's when I'm designing web pages. I am in that play realm of motivation. I'm able to create, experiment, follow my curiosity. I'm even able to fail. When I do, I hear from it from a lot of people. But as long as I learn from it, it's okay. But that's play to me. I could do that probably 18 hours a day and just continue doing that. I just love it. So that's an example of when someone's motivated to do work because they just enjoy the work itself. So what I'm going to ask right now is for you guys, we're going to just share a few examples here. You can either voice it or you can type it in the chat window, but I want you to think about what creative things do you do or have you done that really feel like play to you? So you can, if you want to press star 1 to unmute your phone, click the microphone symbol next to your name. Just tell us your name and where you're calling or where you're dialing us or joining us from today.
I guess I can go first if needed.
Yes, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, this is Brian Etling calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I can give you a motivation from today that's really was play for me is I sat down and I was able to spend most of the day putting together writing an op-ed for Earth Day, and I just loved doing that. I loved writing it and then crafting it down to exactly 750 words, which I know my newspaper is kind of has their word count limit, but I love that writing process, kind of how you like working on the computer side of things. I like the writing side of things.
Awesome. Thank you. That's exactly what we're talking about. And we were in our staff call the other day, and Danny Richter, our legislative director, shared with us that he got into some programming the other day, and he just got lost in it. And he's like, that's really what motivates me. And it's like, oh, maybe I should help get Danny to help out some with the website. That would be a great idea. But so Brian, thank you so much for sharing. So when we go through these other motivators, we'll ask other people to share as well. I appreciate you stepping up and doing that. And so we're going to make an analogy here. I'm going to carry this analogy throughout the rest of the direct motivators. But also think about a teacher. So a teacher may also be at play or experience that highest level of motivation when they're doing things like creating lesson plans or problem solving or maybe thinking of ways to relate to a student. Some teachers even like creating tests, right? So that might be a teacher at play. Not everyone likes that part of it, but there may be a teacher that's at play when they're doing those things. So play again. You do the work because you just enjoy the work itself. That's the greatest motivator. Brian had a great example of it. I mean, he loves to write, and that was something he just loved doing, and it just motivated him. So, you know, creating the condition where folks can play, right, follow their curiosity, experiment, create, is essential for creating an adaptive, high-performing organization. And I think, you know, CCO at the national level, there's no better example of that I can think of doing this. Marshall and Mark have created that type of organization that allows us to do that. It's fantastic. So in terms of creating a high-performing culture, the second strongest motivator is purpose. And so the definition of purpose is at the top. It says you work because you believe in the mission. Now, I think purpose is the reason most of us volunteer with CCL, right? Most of us don't volunteer because we love creating political will, because we really believe in the outcome, right? The outcome being a livable world. Again, that's the second strongest motivator. To continue along with the teacher analogy, a teacher with purpose really may not enjoy doing those creative things I mentioned earlier, you know, creating tests or relating to students, but they believe in the outcome, a lot of them do, right? So therefore, they're motivated by the purpose. The outcome there is helping kids learn. So it's the second highest motivator that you can have. What other places, again, we'll stop here and ask you now, outside of CCL, and maybe even outside of the environmental movement, save those two examples, what are the places have you seen or you've seen people who are motivated by purpose? You can press star one or put the little microphone symbol next to your name. No one? Okay.
Ricky?
Yes, there we go.
If no one else is going to chime in, it's Ashley.
Okay. Ashley, where are you joining us from today?
Long Island.
All
right. I feel for you, man, when no one answers. My liaison calls when no one answers. It makes me wonder if I got cut off. For purpose, I ride my bike. I'm a cyclist. And I tell you what, when you're on your bike and cars are driving dangerously past you and your life is in their hands, that's a big purpose there. So I get motivated to, call my elected officials locally and just ask for more bike lanes.
Ah, there you go. So, the idea there. You're motivated by the outcome, which is getting more bike lanes. I like it. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Ashley, you did say also your play motivator, you typed it in the chat window. You said, as a marketing events director, I love when I get to read current events on climate change and schedule posts for Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And even though conference events are very busy for me, I love being there, meeting all volunteers, and seeing them excited. I think Ashley's just really trying to promote the conference on our
You caught me.
Well, that is a perfect example of our next motivator, actually, what Ashley was doing there. is our next motivator is the potential motivator. So I'm just making fun of you, Ashley, but so play is the strongest motivator and purpose is the second strongest motivator. That leaves potential as the final direct or positive motivator. Now, it's the weakest of the direct motives in the motive spectrum, but it does still contribute positively towards that idea of adaptive performance. And potential is when you enjoy doing an activity because you like an indirect outcome, right? So remember, purpose is about direct outcomes or the mission, like livable world or creating a political will. But potential is when you're working due to an indirect outcome of the work, to learn new skills, to advance your career. You see some intrinsic value in doing the job. So Ashley, being able to call tonight was just to promote her conference. That was her potential. Just mess with you, Ashley. All right. So continuing with the teacher theme, maybe they're doing the job because they see it as a stepping stone to become administrator, right? Maybe they don't really like the creative part, the doing the tests, the connecting with the students. Maybe they're not really interested that much in the kids becoming, you know, great students or helping them learn, but maybe they just want to become a principal. So that might be sort of the potential that they see in their work. So another example of that would be as well, you know, for a lot of people, they go to school, you know, college and stuff. It's not really because they like to learn, but they see the potential of going to college to helping them get into another career or into a chosen career. So it's sort of a potential or indirect outcome. So that's it for the motives that maximize adaptive performance. Now, we mentioned three other motives, and we'll spend a little bit of time on them, but keep in mind, again, to create the conditions within which people motivate themselves, you should try to maximize play, purpose, and potential and minimize the following ones, okay? So the weakest of the indirect motivators is what's called emotional pressure. And actually, we just had an example of it when we asked for sharing. And that was the reason I wanted to kind of bring up sharing, and because I think it actually plays into a little bit of what I'm talking about here. But emotional pressure contributes negatively towards adaptive performance. The more emotional pressure you feel, the lower your adaptive performance, right? So you feel emotional pressure when you're doing something because you feel guilty or ashamed if you did. Or you do an activity because if you don't, you'll feel disappointed in yourself or someone will be disappointed in you. Now, as group leaders and as liaisons and just people in general, we should really do our best to minimize that emotional pressure. Now, I'll be honest, and I'm sure other group leaders feel this way at times as well. It's like, I see and feel emotional pressure when I compare like my team's stats to the rest of the stats of the teams in my region, right? I compare myself to them. I see the letters to the editor that they got, the meetings that they got. And I do. I feel some of this emotional pressure that I didn't achieve as much as they did. I mean, it's just sort of there, right? And that can have a demotivating effect on people. And in some cases, I would argue that it's better for us maybe to share with how we were successful at doing something, so create a sharing or citizenship environment, rather than how successful we are. How successful sometimes creates that competition. It's not always the case, but it can. Here's another example I bet we can all relate to, of emotional pressure. How many of us have been in this situation where we're sitting around in our groups and someone says, okay, we're going to need someone to do this. And it's just crickets, right? It's awkward. It's really awkward. Just like when I asked for someone to share and it was really quiet there for a minute. It's awkward, right? Well, what you find out pretty quickly is what doesn't motivate everyone in your team, right? Because that's not something that motivates them. But what also has happened is that everyone in the group feels just a little bit of more of emotional pressure at that point as well, right? It's almost like they feel kind of bad that they didn't share or they didn't step up to the plate to take on that task. And so there's a better ways. I think that there's better ways of doing it than asking people in a group setting, a group environment, and we can talk about that in a little bit as well. But that's an example of emotional pressure as well. And, you know, parents, if for those of you who are parents, you're probably really good at emotional pressure, right? You use it on your kids all the time to get them to do things. But as leaders and group leaders and, you know, in our organization, I think it's something we need to make sure constantly that we're not using emotional pressure to get people to motivate them. So emotional pressure lessens that adaptive performance. The next thing that we have, and I don't think we have much of this at CCL, it's the second strongest of the indirect motivators, is economic pressure. And as a volunteer organization, obviously we don't have a lot of that, but that makes sense to me. I mean, right, if there's a large amount of economic pressure to do something, then you've really completely separated yourself from the work, right? You're really just doing something because of the economic gain. Now, if it's done well, if you do create economic incentives well, it can produce short-term results. We all know that. But it doesn't normally lead to higher motivation or adaptive performance. And then the last of the motivators is inertia. It's the strongest of the indirect motivators, or the negative motivators. And this is when you do an activity because it's what you did yesterday, right? You really don't even, can't even identify where the motive is coming from anymore. Why are you even doing the work? You're just punching the time clock, right? And, you know, we've seen examples of this in the past. So this is the worst place that someone can be in, right? And if we see someone who's in this inertia mode, we should really have some discussion, because it's probably bringing down the rest of the group or the team as well. So emotional and economic pressure and inertia really cancel out any natural sense of play, right? So it reduces all those adaptive behaviors that we want to foster, like creativity, experimentation, persistence, and citizenship. So I think at this point you're probably all asking yourselves, okay, so this all sounds pretty straightforward and common. Then why don't we have more high-performing cultures, right? Why do we not have these? Like, are they not everywhere? It's actually a pretty simple answer. The answer is this, is that human beings and organizations have a bias to lead with the wrong motivators. Now, I think this makes sense as well when you think about why would most organizations spend an inordinate amount of time focusing on indirect motivators? And you have to think about how is our economic system, and this is not a critique of our economic system, but it's just the way it is, but we're built on short-term results, quarterly reports, monthly sales goals, right? And so we know that you can put economic pressure on people to get those results. And so as human beings and organizations, the reason why we don't have more high-performing cultures is because it's so much easier to motivate people with economic pressure to produce short-term results. Now, the good news is that this bias to motivate this way, it's not a gene or something that's hardwired. It can be undone. So we're going to move on from talking about why some organizations are failing to achieve a high-performing culture and spend the rest of our time here tonight talking about the keys to creating that great culture. The hope here is that we can begin working together to foster the right type of culture within our groups that really allow for this self-motivation, creating the culture that maximizes adaptive performance. So what can we begin to do now to create the culture that maximizes adaptive performance? A few things. First, what we need to know is that a high-performing or a great culture starts with finding the right roles for people and putting people in the right role, one that's well-crafted, are the two most important factors in increasing motivation. How you can think about this is your typical workplace. In a typical workplace environment, you probably have 40 or 50 employees, 10 to 12 managers, maybe a director or a couple of directors, and a president, you know, all above them, right? And that's the way it's set up. The way it's set up is that everyone who wants to move up that corporate ladder really is competing against their colleagues. Managers compete against each other to become a director. Directors compete against each other to become president one day. This internal competition turns into a tournament where folks really compete against each other rather than directing all their efforts towards competition against a competitor. The tournament or this competition, it changes your motive. So instead of doing the work for play, purpose, or potential, you're now doing it for a big reward, economic pressure, or to build avoid like feeling like a loser, you know, with some emotional pressure, right? And all of that can lead to, or you know, to worsen adaptive performance. So therein lies the conundrum. Sort of in this corporate world that we have in America, you know, we have restricted competitive career ladders that make us spend a lot of time thinking about how to get ahead instead of having to do the work. But we're not constricted by that with CCL, which is really cool, right? So how can we create opportunities without damaging total motivation? And I think the answer therein lies with giving each person his or her own individualized role. And I think we do a very good job of this at CCL, but I think we could always be doing better. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. I'm the worst at this, or I used to be the worst at this, I've changed. But when a new person would join my group, did I used to ask them about, you know, what it is they'd like to do with CCL? Or did I try to force them into completing some task that I had open or filling a role that I felt needed to be filled? Right? So was I trying to find out what motivated them, or was I trying to get a tactic completed? To place people in the proper role, one that maximizes play, purpose, and potential, and minimizes those other three, we've begun asking people when they join our chapters, hey, what is it you want to do within CCL? First meeting, plop down a volunteer opportunities handout, their own CCL community. We ask them, fill it out. I'll explain, here are the things we do. We do lobbying, we do outreach, we do media work, and you know, we also have this chapter development, we do growth and those types of things. You don't have to tell me right now, but I want you to think about those things and come back. Let's talk in a week, and I want to find out what it is that motivates you. I can guarantee you I've never seen anyone so far put anything down that doesn't motivate them. So I know right there that I'm finding out exactly what motivates them. So finding out or putting people in the proper role is the best first step. But it's not just about putting them in a role and then turning them loose. There's also the design of the role. And this is where it gets a little tricky and a little creative for group leaders as well, that you can do different things. There's no structure to this, so we can be creative as possible as we want to do here. The research shows that putting people into a well-crafted role is the second best thing we can do to motivate performance. A well-designed role is one with a clear purpose, some key tasks, and an end state or an outcome. So when people are clear on the objective, they can accomplish a task without needing micromanagement. It enables them to experiment, adapt within identified boundaries, and that's really a behavior that increases motivation. And there's another part to this as well, and I think this is particularly important for CCL. Like when there is a large task or project, what we're trying to do is a very large task or project, people need to see the small victories, and they need to understand how their work contributed to that achievement. That's extremely important. They need to understand how their work actually contributes to the overall objective. So the military uses this concept. They have a long tradition of using objectives to give people flexibility in how they work. And what the military calls this is commander's intent. What that means is every soldier has to understand the intent of a mission so that if the plan fails, soldiers can improvise. The best example of this, the example I know that I really like to discuss is when Napoleon was actually, he lost a few battles, not just Waterloo, but when he was invading or trying to invade Great Britain or England or UK, whatever it was back in those days, with his navy, he really had an overwhelming force and a superior navy. And the British general, I can't remember his name off the top of my head right now, I just lost it, but he knew this going in. And back in those days, navies used to line up parallel to each other. And what they would do, they would line up parallel because that's where you would launch the cannons and that's how they would engage in a fight. But the British general knew that, and also the reason they got in a parallel line was because you could see down to the flagship. And the flagship was the head ship that would run up flags on the mast so people would know what the orders were. Each flag meant a different order. Well, the general knew that he was outnumbered, and there was no way that they could just line up next to each other and bombard each other. His navy would be destroyed. So before the battle started, he made sure that every ship knew exactly what the orders were, and the orders were to charge straight ahead. Don't line up, charge straight ahead. You won't be able to see us, you won't be able to understand what the any other orders, but you know the intent here is to protect England. And that was it, and they won. So that's the idea and the concept of commander's intent, is if our volunteers understand exactly what their roles are and what their objectives are, we can allow them the flexibility to go out and do those things. So after asking my team to tell me what motivates them within CCL, I was really able to help define some clear roles. One, I'll give you an example of what I'll call my CEO, or we're calling our CEO now. It's not chief executive officer, it's my chief endorsement officer. This was someone who had expressed severe disinterest in lobbying their member of Congress. Let me say that again. This is someone who did not want to have anything to do with lobbying their member of Congress. And I'd always assumed that everyone joined CCL to lobby, right? But this person was just not into it. This person felt like the best way for them to contribute would be endorsements from major companies in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. She felt like, this is the way I can contribute. I don't want to lobby my member of Congress. That's what I want to do. So the purpose of her role is to create political will in the district amongst business and community leaders. Her tasks are scheduling meetings, assembling lobbying teams, mentoring possibly new endorsement team members. And obviously the end state will be when she's got enough endorsements that Congress in sessions changes his mind and supports carbon fee and dividend. Now, we realize that may never happen, but that's the end state. So finding the right role for people and designing it well are the keys to creating high-performing culture. I was trying to force her into a lobby role because she is just so dynamic, and she's such a great communicator, and she understood our policy, but I was pushing her into a role that she did not want to do. And she actually dropped out for years when she came back, when we had started asking people to sign up or fill out these opportunity handout forms. There's one other thing I'd like to touch on as well, and then we're going to stop and open it up and have you guys share and tell me some of your experiences and maybe some of these things that you're doing already within your groups or your chapters that's related to this. But there's one other key that I'd like to touch on that we should begin and continue doing all the time. And that's telling our story. I don't think we do this enough within CCL. And it's something that we're trying to do a lot of here in Texas now. Reflect on our identity, who we are and what we stand for. And saying it over and over increases purpose for sure. And often it can increase play as well. One of the things we talk about on our regional group leader calls for the past couple of months is that we're beginning every one of our meetings with culture now. So our group at local chapter meetings, we stop at the very beginning of the meeting. We have our little introductions and everyone gets to know each other. But then we stop. The first thing we do is we tell a story about CCL or someone who sought after and found the best in someone else, someone who found common ground or someone who built a relationship with someone who may not be considered a natural ally of ours. Maybe it's something inspirational. Maybe it's a case where we demonstrated respect, appreciation, and gratitude in a really trying situation. But this is our culture at CCL, and I think it's something we always tell our folks about, our history, our traditions, our culture, whenever we can. We have so many new people coming in constantly to our organization. I don't think we can do this enough. And the high-performing organizations, they do it all the time. They lead off – a lot of high-performing organizations lead off every one of their meetings with a culture moment. Starting off this meeting this way – especially when you have newcomers, it really sets the right tone right from the start. So begin to figure out how you can incorporate our culture within every meeting to talk and discuss those things. All right, so the key learnings from tonight, play, purpose, and potential. These are direct motivators that maximize the concept of adaptive performance. Adaptive performance, again, the ability to diverge from a plan, to be creative, to experiment, to try new things. Emotional, economic, and inertia are things that weaken adaptive performance. So we should be looking for ways to minimize or lessen these as much as we can within our groups and our chapters and even our organization. The goal, again, is high level of adaptive performance. The method is creating the context within which people will motivate themselves. And the tools to doing this, finding the right roles for people, designing those roles, and then all constantly reflecting on our identity and telling our culture and our story. So we all do a lot of tactical things. We schedule meetings, do communications, and those kinds of things. Just the thing that I would, you know, that we're, I think we're finding a lot of success for with here lately, locally, and here in Texas and Third Coast, because we're trying, we're really focused on this, is that we're getting higher levels of performance from our groups because we're really focusing on how do we find the right role, how do we design those roles, and how do we motivate, or how do we create the conditions, and that's it, finding the roles and designing them properly so folks can motivate themselves. All right, so I'm going to, that's the end of the presentation tonight. We got about, I did a lot of talking there, so I apologize. What I would like to do here, though, is you obviously stop and take questions. Just one disclaimer, I'll say, you know, this is not a CCL focus at this point. This is just some ideas for people to chew on and to consider. And what I'd really like to do is to hear from you, from others out there. You know, have you tried similar concepts like this within your groups, your chapters? Do you have some other types of experiences with, you know, trying to motivate people in different ways? And what's worked and what hasn't worked for you guys? So if you can press star 1 on your phone to mute or unmute yourself. And then if you're joining us online as well, you can click the little microphone symbol next to your name.
Ricky, it's Tasha.
Yes, who is this?
Hi, this is Alice in Delaware, Ohio. At our last, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you just fine. Go ahead.
Okay. At our last meeting, our co-leader, my co-leader, handed out these little help wanted slips to each person in the group. And one had, with different tasks or different roles on them, and then collected them at the end of the meeting. And that was, you know, everybody filled out something they really, this their thing that they really like to do. And so that kind of ties into what you were talking about tonight. But so far, we just did it. So I don't, how it's going to work out so far, I don't know. But
well, that's
anyway,
fantastic.
That
I like
idea.
The concept. Yeah, yeah. I love it calling it help wanted, too. That's kind of an interesting
right.
angle to take on it. I think the, and you may just want to pass this on to you, you know, to your co-leader as well. I think the most interesting thing we found that when we did that, just all the conversations that we started having and all the assumptions that we had about what people wanted to do were gone.
Right.
And we had, then we had some really good conversations with people, and it just sort of, I don't know why, but it just changed sort of the dynamic. And like you said, I think there are a lot of groups already doing that. So I appreciate you sharing that example. That's perfect.
And it really illuminates the fact that you make assumptions about what certain people would want to do that turn out to be totally incorrect.
Absolutely.
Like you said.
Well, great. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that. Does anyone else have anything to share as far as some things that you're doing within your chapters to motivate others, or any comments or questions on what we talked about tonight?
Hey, Ricky, this is Dave. Should
hey,
I jump in?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, just a comment and a question. For maybe the last year and a half, we send a sign-up sheet around during our meetings. And often those are things for kind of immediate tasks, like writing a letter to the editor or tabling in an event or something like that. But I think that's been kind of consistent with what you're saying, because again, people sign up for things that they want to do. You know, we also often will reach out to somebody and ask them if they would do something. But I think the sign-up sheet allows people, it's another way of just having people kind of self-select what they want to do. My question is though, kind of in role design, Could you just elaborate a little bit more on that? Because I think often when I've asked people to do things, you know, we kind of talk about the tasks in general, things like that. But I really haven't structured it, you know, particularly having anything written or something like that. And so I just wonder what you or maybe other people's experience has been when you ask somebody to do something.
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I probably should have elaborated a little bit more on that. And but we can continue having these discussions as we go along. But so here's an example. So I think just, you know, as you write, so we asked everyone to fill out the sheets, and then we had conversations with them. And so I was able, you know, one person, you know, I said, you know, she said she marked on the sheet that, you know, she would like to, or she already reads the paper every day, so she'll be our letter person. So I called it the letter to the editor scout, right? And we said, here's your purpose. You know, your purpose is to, you know, we wrote it out, you know. I mean, you don't have to be this formal. I think it lended a little bit of kind of fun to the exercise, but we said, you know, your purpose is to watch, you know, read the paper every day, or, you know, monitor the paper every day and alert the team that wants to write letters, to maintain the list of people who want to write letters, and alert that team every day, right? And so the outcome will be that we're going to be seeing more letters. And so she's actually keeping up with our letter to the editor total. So I've given her complete control of that and letting her own that process. And so I just, you know, give it a name. I called her the letter to the editor scout, right? I don't think that there's anything magic to this, and I think everyone can do it a different way. But, you know, just saying, here's the, make sure the people that who are willing to take on a certain role just understand the purpose, the task associated with it, and then what the outcome is, because it's very important for them to see the outcome of their work. Does that make a little more sense? Yeah, I would like, if you're doing some of this, I would like to start sharing that as well, because I think it would, if we can share with each other how we're doing and how we're structuring these more in our groups, I think it will benefit everybody. I think I heard someone else. Yeah, go ahead. Who's this?
No, this is Amy. I this has made me think. I really like this approach. I wanted to share what I used to do in my other life, which was manage a volunteer program for an animal services organization. And I'd take people who are interested in volunteering on actually a 3-hour tour of the facility. And first, we'd meet in a room, and I would post all of the opportunities on different sheets of paper around the room, describing what they were, and people would kind of mingle and look around at those. Then we'd go on a tour, and I'd definitely find people who were volunteering, and I would stop them and ask them to describe what they were doing, and whether they were walking a dog or they were doing therapeutic riding with a disabled child or working in the large animal hospital. And by letting that person who was actually doing the volunteer activity explain it, it was like they were hearing from someone who was in love with what they were doing. And then we'd go back into this orientation, and then people would ask questions and get all excited, and then they would start to identify what really lights them up. And then we'd set a time later to talk about, okay, is that going to, you know, let's talk more privately or, you know, individually about, you know, getting you into that program. But what was really fun for the folks who went on the tour was to hear from someone who was actually, you know, working in the therapeutic riding program. And I could see that in a CCL meeting where you ask whoever writes letters to the editor to explain what that is, and for someone who has never been in a lobby meeting to explain what that is, because sometimes, you know, what you think it is and what it really is are two different things.
Yeah. Yeah. I love it. Thank you. I love it. I love it. Love it. That's really, it's good to see, you know, like what you said, just sort of being able to relate this to what other organizations are doing. I just think, you know, it's just, I struggled for a long time as a group leader thinking that, oh, I just had all these tasks that I had to complete. And I think now I'm at the point and that, you know, if there are certain tasks that aren't finished, that's just too bad. I've got, you know, I've got the right people in the right roles, and I'm trying to get them motivated to do those things. I don't want to force people to do things that they don't want to do. Now, I think there is a little disclaimer here. I think, and Amy, you can, and Ellie and Ashley, people who have been around for a long time, there's also this concept of stepping outside of your comfort zone to do things that, you know, you've never done before as well. I just think that there's a, it takes the, you have to know the right person to do something like that, and it has to be when they're ready for it a little bit as well. You know, that when someone first comes into the organization, I think it's best to find the things that motivate them and make sure that they're in the right role. And then as they become more comfortable, they can step outside of their comfort zone.
Ricky, it's Tasha.
Yeah, hey, Tasha.
So Silicon Valley North chapter, maybe a year or so ago, started creating roles for our members, and it worked out really well. And I can't claim that it was my idea in the first place. It was mostly one of our members who just had an idea of what he wanted to do, and we didn't even have that on the list of things to do. He was basically wanted to be our liaison to other local chapters. So he would, like, you know, talk to the group leaders on the phone, show up at their meetings, and so we could, so we could have a tighter bond between the other chapters in our region. And so then it went from there, and we started creating all sorts of different roles that other people were interested in doing. We had a lot of luck with that.
Well, that's great. Maybe we can get some of those. We can find out some of those are. We can create, or just give some more examples for folks and share more examples for other groups that will help them. And I love the idea of allowing that person to find their own role. I think that is so important. I mean, that's why I'm motivated to do the job I do with web development every day, because it's the role I wanted to do. So I sort of created the role. It's easy. I think Ellie and Ashley and Amy are probably the same way. We didn't see that there was a role there and apply for it. We just sort of kind of moved in and created the roles ourselves, which I think what you're saying, Tasha, that's the best thing that you can do, right? And it's the highest motivator for sure. Someone else said there's a chat comment here. From Ashley. Ashley, do you want to say what you were? It's a long comment. I can read it if you're okay. Ashley said, in May, our Long Island chapter is hosting an open house inspired by Columbia County, New York chapter in Chris Gibson's district. We plan to have a bunch of tables around the room representing the CCL levers, outreach, presentations, LTEs, lobbying, etc. We're going to do 3 guest expert speakers on different facets of climate change for 20 minutes at the top of the hour, or each hour, to motivate. Then after that, do a 20-minute CCL motivational pitch focusing on our accomplishments. The last 20 minutes, we'll have mingling, socializing, and visiting the lever table. I'm excited. So allows them to sort of self-select while they're there at an actual meeting. I love it. Okay. Great idea. Anyone have any comments or thoughts or questions?
Ricky?
Yeah.
Ricky, this is Jerry in Rochester. Can you just elaborate a little bit more about the last thing you spoke of, about starting the meeting with a cultural moment, something inspirational? That be something personal that the chapter did, or something that we read on the CCL National blog? Or could you just give a couple examples?
Sure, absolutely. And a great, great question. And I think it's really kind of whatever you want to do. I would love for us to get to where on our action sheet we actually had something that we could share with, you know, as a default, but then also inspire our group leaders to find something. So what we asked our group leaders to do – hang on 1 second, Jerry. I'm going to mute you right now. Get a little feedback. But what we're doing is as we get, like, close to the chapter meeting each month – we'll send out a note to the group leaders. Hey, tell us, do you have a cultural moment, something that happened during the past month that you think is really inspirational? And so, for example, the first time we ever did anything, we actually played, Ellie had sent out a recording of how this person who worked for the NRA, the National Rifle Association, had actually become good friends with someone who worked for this guns educational research group or something. It was an NPR story. But it was inspirational, the fact that it showed how two people who were diametrically opposed to each other could actually find common ground and build a relationship. Another time, one of my volunteers, somewhere in Texas, had a son who had returned from the war, and he didn't have health insurance, and this guy, this member of CCL, had to contact his member of Congress who he despised. But what he found out was that what a member of Congress says sometimes behind closed doors and what they say to a constituent on the phone and what they really mean are two different things. And his congressman was able to help him get enrolled in Obamacare because he had some really life-threatening issues. It can also be stories about CCL, right? I think we shared the story, you know, obviously about how Jay Butera single-handedly pretty much, you know, got the Climate Solutions Caucus started. That was a huge story that we definitely talked about. Just those sort of cultural moments, and they can be smaller things as well, absolutely. But just finding something that sets the tone at the beginning of the meeting, because we have so many new folks, and I think we're usually just ready to kind of dive in and get going, that it sets the tone and it creates the right feel for the meeting.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're approaching the top of the hour, so here's what I'll do is I will definitely want to get with Tasha and get some ideas on some things that they have done. If you guys have other examples of roles that different groups have created, you know, not that we're going to try to force people into roles, but, you know, just so other people have an idea of these are the roles that you could possibly ask someone if they want to take on, that would help. And if you guys have any other comments or any other questions, you can certainly email me. My name is Ricky at, or my email address is ricky@citizensclimate.org. But it is the top of the hour, so I'm going to turn you guys loose tonight. We're off for CCL University or CC University next week. In 2 weeks, we're going to have tabling. So I know I understand there's a lot of people who are getting ready for tabling for Earth Day events coming up here soon. So I have a tabling lesson. And that we'll be using our new platform, GoToWebinar. So there'll be some communication next week about how to use GoToWebinar. It's a much more stable and robust platform. We're excited to have it. So thank you, everyone, for tonight. I appreciate all the feedback and all the comments and the best practices. And we'll be talking to you soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, good night. Good night.